And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to everybody who became a member of WIPR in our fall membership drive, which concluded yesterday. We are very, very grateful to everybody who contributed. Today on Midday, conversations with two novelists who've written books about racial inequality, liberation, and integration. They are very different stories, but they are both insightful, provocative, and compelling. Naima Koster is the author of What's Mine and Yours. We'll talk with Naima a little later in the program. But we begin with Dr. Wendy Shaya, who serves on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Social Work and as the executive director of the Social Work Community Outreach Service. For years, she's done anti-racism work, and she's written numerous scholarly articles. Her first novel is set in Baltimore in the near future. It imagines a secret organization of black men and women who train and organize for armed resistance to white supremacy. It is part dystopian fiction and part ripped from the headlines, part Wakanda and part consent decree, part Black Panther movement, and part Unite the Right. It's called The Black Cell, and it's been chosen as a finalist in the American Fiction Awards. Tomorrow, Wendy Shaya will talk about it at Busboys and Poets here in Baltimore. She joins us here on Midday today on Zoom. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. It's good to be here.
And congratulations on the book. This is a very compelling read. It's really, really thought-provoking and beautifully crafted. Tell us a little bit about the Black Cell and the Black Resistance Movement and what forms that resistance takes.
Yes, absolutely. So in the book is set in 2024, and it imagines a time where a white nationalist president is coming to power, which doesn't seem quite so out of the realm of possibilities. And in response, we really see in the country a rise of white nationalism. And so black people, starting in Baltimore, really have begun to come together to think about and to plan for how they will resist this rise of white nationalism, this movement to send black people and brown people back to chains or out of the country. And so it really is a story of what community looks like. It is a reimagination of what the Black Panthers used to do for black communities that was eventually, stopped. And so it's really about building community and supporting each other. It's something I really believe we can do.
You know, as I mentioned, it's part dystopian and also part ripped from the headlines. As you mentioned, it's set in 2024. That's just a couple of years away. The rise of the alt, which is how it's called in the book and even called, in contemporary reality, is something that, has been a terrible, blight on the political landscape here in Baltimore. There have been, in fact, predictions now of, an armed, political, racialized civil war. Did you start envisioning that at any particular moment in time, in the last few years?
Certainly. I have certainly asked the question about whether or not liberation can come without violence. I think to answer some of those questions, we really have to go back in history. And one of the reasons I think it is not such a far-fetched idea is that when, the white supremacist killings of black people starting in around 1919 and going through the Tulsa massacre, those all came on the heels of the Spanish flu, which was a pandemic. And it was just, it's an interesting idea that there are things, there are events that can really stimulate this kind of white supremacy and this kind of racialized violence. So the question I have always asked is, what will be the response of black communities if this really does happen? And so in some ways, it is a sort of thinking forward of what has happened in the past and just trying to figure out what this could look like in the future. I don't think it's so far-fetched.
Oh, gosh, no, it's not in the least far-fetched. It's scary, but it's not in the least far-fetched. But when we use the term Black liberation, what does that mean? What are the components of liberation? In the book, one of the characters says, we've got to stop begging them to see us. This is not about hating white people. It's about loving ourselves. But what it's a complex notion, liberation. What does it mean to you and to the characters in the book?
Sure. So I really believe that. So I'm an immigrant. I came to this country. My family's Jamaican. And we have many of the same stories in the Caribbean and around the African diaspora. But this idea of liberation is really about Black people or any group of people, right? It doesn't just have to be Black people. But in this case, Black liberation is really about having the ability to be self-determined, to really make our lives what we want it to be, not to have to accept the dregs of what is given in this society, this idea that we have power and that if we can all recognize our power, and it doesn't really matter whether you have, you know, money or education, but we all do have power. And when we put that power together, we really can make things happen for ourselves. We really can be self-determined and figure out for ourselves as a people what needs to happen so that our children can grow healthy and strong and not have to make decisions that other groups of people don't have to make, that we have opportunities and that we can live our lives in freedom, right? Without being at the bottom of all of the measures of well-being as Black people are currently. It really is about being free and being able to make our own decisions.
The book is The Black Cell. The author is my guest, Wendy Shaya. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to join us, if you have a question or comment for Wendy Shaya, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet as well. And Wendy, the notion of community is extraordinarily important in this book. The fact that Eurocentric white supremacist values are a barrier to Black liberation because those values are in many instances contrary to the values of Mother Africa, as you refer to it in the book, which valued community. You say at one point one of the characters says we've become like crabs in a bucket, even willing to step on each other on our way to success, but our original Mother Africa values have been beaten out of us. We're tired of living in white systems that say you are nothing. Talk about how community and the values of community, which come from African tradition, are in contrast to white values in that regard.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, in African cultures and throughout the diaspora, we came from collectivist cultures where people had to work together and live together and share. And in fact, in many ways, Europeans were like that at one point. But over time, European values have really stressed the importance of individualism and the ability to make your own way. And that, in fact, people really should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which really doesn't make sense. And this idea that everybody should be able to make it. And if I worked really hard to make it, then you need to do the same thing. And if you haven't worked really hard, then if you haven't made it, it's because you haven't worked really hard. And we know that's not true. We know that's not true for a lot of people. We know a lot of people are working very hard, but they don't have the opportunities that other people have. And so how do we come together as community to make sure that everybody eats, everybody has a good place to live, everybody has all their needs met. I really believe that it is in our DNA as Black people. I actually think it's in European DNA, but it goes much farther back. And I think that we need to find that ability to come together and to really support each other. That's what I think about when I think about community, liberation community.
Yeah, the members of the Black Cell in the book talk about community wealth building. There's a term you use called money susu. And this reminds me of there are other communities here in Baltimore that we see that happening. Some Black communities in East Baltimore, I know, who are working for collective ownership of real estate assets. I think of the Korean community who help each other when folks come to Baltimore to begin businesses. Talk about how money susu operates.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm a homeowner because of money susu. So what happened is that my family came here as immigrants. They were laborers. My father's an electrician. We had, you know, carpenters and plumbers. And what my family did was is the susu is this community wealth building where you get a group of people together and everybody puts money into the pot. And you know, if there are 10 families and each person's putting $50, each family puts $50 in a week, then you get a pot of $500, and the pot goes around the circle, and you can take your money and you can do with it, go on vacation, do whatever you want. But when my family came here, we didn't do that. We did a money susu, and we kept the money, the circle going for about a couple of years. And they really built up money. And using that money, they bought two abandoned apartment buildings in Baltimore, in New York, and then everybody was out there on the weekends fixing it up, and they rented it, and that was sort of the beginning of some sort of intergenerational wealth. My parents died before they actually ever saw any money from that. But when those apartment buildings were sold, I got my parents' very, very small portion of it, and that was a down payment for my house. My parents would never have been able to leave me any money. And so because of this community wealth building, I and my children are in a much better position than we were when we first came to this country. I think we can do more of that.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world. I mean, I suppose there are, you know, maybe some internet analogies, you know, Kickstarter and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's different. It's different when a specific community of people gets together to help out other individuals, you know, with whom they are related, or they know each other, or they, you know, they're working closely. I wonder also your decision to write a novel, which you've written really beautifully. I mean, a lot of people, you know, when they try their hand at novel writing, it just doesn't come out smoothly, even if it's a nice idea. But you're a really good writer. But it's interesting to me that because your work as a researcher, I mean, you're a PhD teaching at the School of Social Work, etc. Why did you choose a novel to make these very important points about Black liberation?
Well, you know, the truth about academic writing is that it is not intended for everyone. It is a very, you know, I do it. It is important. It really helps us make big decisions about how our world should work. But we do know that only certain people and a certain sort of elite group of people get access to that writing, not only because of where it is placed, but also because of the language that's used. I wanted to write a book that was something that my mother, who had an eighth grade education, would be able to read and would enjoy, would understand, because we're talking about racism here. We're not talking about, you know, some sort of, you know, sophisticated surgery. This is about racism. So this impacts every single person. So every single person needs to be able to have this conversation. I wanted to write a book that was accessible to your 18-year-old, to your 65-year-old, to your person with an eighth grade education. I deliberately wrote the book to be easy to read. At least I tried to make it easy to read, specifically for that reason, because if we leave some people out of the conversation, then we don't have the benefit of the richness of a full community taking part in this.
Well, it certainly is accessible, and it certainly is easy to read, and it's a page turner. I mean, you wanna know what happens. So if you like those kinds of books, this one is for you. We have Adar on the line, and I believe it's Adar Ayira, who is a good friend of mine, a great friend of yours, and I'm indebted to Adar for introducing this book and you to me. Adar, welcome to Midday with your friend Wendy Shia.
Thank you. You all so busted me. thank you so much for taking my call. And Tom, you know I listen every day. And Wendy, I'm such a fan of both of yours. You all were just talking about the intergenerational connection. And one question that I had, Wendy, about the book is that I continue to hear this refrain of this isn't your granddaddy's revolution, this isn't your grandmother's movement, you know, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So reading this book and seeing the way that you have put forth, front and center, the role that every generation has in liberation. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. for me, in reading the book, it really came to a crux when it got to the section about the compound and this place where, you know what I'm talking about? Where everybody.
Yeah. The farm.
And so you talked about this physical facility that it stood the test of time. There was this source of physical protection and hope. And then in that same breath, you talked about elders who were the source of emotional protection and hope. Mm-hmm. Can you mm-hmm. say more about your understanding and why you put front and center the intergenerational role mm-hmm. of liberation? And thank you all so much. I'll listen offline.
Thank you, Adar.
Thanks, Adar. Well, that's a complex question. But I think Adar's right that there is a role for every generation to play. And I think sometimes we are tempted as a society to think that all of our solutions will come from the very young. And so I think that there are many solutions that will come from the very young. They have energy and they have new ways of thinking and they're innovative. But we should never ever forget for a moment our ancestors and what they walked through, because those are the lessons that will help us in the future. And so it is really important. Liberation can't happen for any community, actually, not just the Black community, if all parts of the community are not involved. I really, when Adar talks about this farm, which is a place that the Black cell kept, that people could run to in times of intense persecution. I thought a lot when I was writing this. I like to say my spirit guides is Nanny of the Maroons. She's one of the Jamaican national heroes, and she was she led the Maroons, who were groups of runaway slaves. And they used to come down out of the mountains and wage war on the British. They would burn the plantations, free the slaves. And they had a lot to do with the ending of enslavement in Jamaica. And so they would go back to their Maroon villages, and the English didn't know where they were. And so I used that kind of as fodder for this to help me really think about what kind of place could this be that's intergenerational, where the young people can sit at the feet of the older people and learn, and where people can be safe. And so that's really all wrapped up in this idea of the farm.
And of course, one of the most wonderful characters in this book, I mean, to my reckoning, is one called Mother Ramla.
Yes.
And she's 90 years old.
Yes.
And she's actually in the very last scene in the book, if I recall correctly. And
yes.
And she's, an important character, as well as these younger characters, Corey and his girlfriend, mm-hmm. Tasia. But you also write about the interracial friendships that, mm-hmm. Several of your characters, because there's a lot of characters in this. This is a huge dramatis personae, which is really interesting. And as an author, just in terms of craft, it's tough to manage all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of the characters, an African-American woman, who she and her family get a house in a nice, safe white neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And she says, "We thought we were safe because we had good incomes and a nice house, but it was a false sense of safety."
That's right.
One of the provocative notions that you force the reader to think about is, is liberation completely dependent on separation? Because mm-hmm. there's obviously so many people who for years have talked about integration as the answer rather than separation. Mm-hmm. How do you take that part of the argument up?
That is a really complex argument. And I know that, I have heard some older Black people say that one of the worst things for Black people in this country was integration. I've heard that many times, and it does give you pause, doesn't it? It makes you think, because this is what we're spending all our time and energy trying to figure out, how we can all be in the same place together. But the truth is that very often we're all in the same place together, but we don't share power. And so just being there does not mean that we are truly integrated. I think we have to ask the question, is it possible for us to all live together? Because honestly, in order for Black people, I'm specifically talking about Black people here, but lots of people of color, groups of people of color, in order for us to build power, it means white people will have to lose some of theirs. How is that gonna work? And why would white people give up power voluntarily? So those are just interesting questions. I think those are questions that are worth asking.
And when it comes to some things, they're not a zero-sum game. But mm-hmm. but when it comes to power, perhaps that is a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's only mm-hmm. one mayor. There's only one governor. You know,
exactly.
There's only one
exactly.
president of a company. There's only one of a lot of things. And if that person is a person of color, that means a white person isn't going to hold that position. But it's also the understanding of history, this notion of Bakra that you write about, mm-hmm. remembering history of the movement determines the future of the movement. Where do you see the future of, you know, in your book, it's the BRM, the Black Resistance Movement, on the streets of our city and many others across the world. It's the Black Lives Matter. It's BLM. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the future of the movement going?
Yeah, that is, you know, I've asked myself that question so many times. I really think it depends on so many things. It depends on whether Black people, and of course, you know, Black people, we're not a monolith, right? So there are lots of different groups of people with different sets of values and different ways of thinking. But I do think that we are going to be called on to support each other. I really do believe that, you know, I don't know what the 2024 election will look like, but we definitely see a movement in this country. We definitely see a rise in white nationalism. We definitely see that, you know, when our previous president was elected, that it freed a lot of white people to say and do things they would not normally do. If you have seen some of the responses from white people that I have gotten to this book, you would really, it's very sobering, let me put it that way, about how people really think. And so I do think at some point, we may have to come to a point where we make a decision about how we fight, how we retreat, or how we just live with things the way they are. And I don't know what that decision will be.
Of course, you're exactly right that, you know, Black people are not a monolith. In the Baltimore cell, in this book, and I think of folks like Davon Love, who's working with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and other organizations mm-hmm. like that here in town, they talk about taking care of ourselves, our own economy, mm-hmm. our own education, our own security, mm-hmm. and ending dependence on white society and white organizations. Mm-hmm. But do you see a consensus building that we do need these exclusively Black institutions to take care of people of color in this city and elsewhere?
You know, I think there is a good chance that we need things like that. I mean, you know, I work in the social service arena, and I can tell you that it continues to be a space where people of color get less and are most impacted by the structural issues in our country. And we are not actually we're changing in small ways. Individual people, small groups, but large scale. If you look across what's happening for Black people in this country, economically, things have not improved significantly for us in the last generation or the last couple of generations. It's been mostly symbolic. And so at some point, it may be necessary for us to figure out how to take care of our own. Or else it may be that we begin to splinter even more than we already have, in the sense that those who have are taking care of themselves and their families, and those who don't will suffer. But at the end of the day, if some people are suffering, we're all suffering. In fact, if some people are suffering in this society, doesn't matter what color you are, you are going to be, there's an opportunity cost, because all of those people who could have been everything they wanted to be and could have contributed to this culture and this society don't have the opportunity. We all lose when that happens. So we may have to make some difficult decisions. I think that it's going to be very hard. And that's why this is a novel.
Yeah, well, it is going to be very hard. And those kinds of provocative questions have to be asked and thought about and pondered. They absolutely do. And you do a beautiful job of presenting it. Wendy Shia, her debut novel is called The Black Cell. It's been chosen as a finalist in the American Fiction Awards. Wendy Shia will talk about the book tomorrow at 4:00 at Busboys and Poets in Baltimore. We've got link to information on that on the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. So, Wendy, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And coming up, Naima Koster is the author of a novel that's been chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book. We'll talk about what's mine and yours after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Fight the hand that feeds you and maim your oppressors. Every step we take must honor our ancestors. I was in a school when I had to learn this lesson. We couldn't get a job, so clocking with a Smith & Wesson. We are not worth less than those with privilege, but they're gonna feel threatened when it's the cause of congression. We're living in hell while we begging for a blessing. Getting on our knees in front of the devil won't get us to heaven. Every time we protest, we lose a life or two. With that burner on his belt, he wanted you to blow a fuse. Don't you...
This is 88.1. WYPR.